You're listening to The Pivot, brought to you by Globally News, where we discuss the leaders, states, networks, ideologies, and technologies that are reshaping the world order. Visit our website at globally.news. That's globe.news.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Pivot. My name is Ara Shafiq, and I'm your host. Israel's war on Gaza is now in its sixth month, and with the Palestinian death toll well over 30,000, many voices are now describing Israel's campaign as a genocide. Amid the mass carnage, famine also looms, or has already begun in parts of Gaza, a region that's home to more than 2 million people. Alongside this unfolding catastrophe, there's talk of the day after, of who will enforce control or rule Gaza if and once the Israeli military campaign comes to an end, and what kind of political future awaits the Palestinian people. These questions have been the subject of conversations in Washington, Ramallah, Cairo, and elsewhere in the Middle East. And to discuss all this, we're joined by Khalil Saeg, a political analyst born and raised in Gaza and the co-founder of the Agora Initiative. Khalil offers a unique perspective. He's a Palestinian Christian who, until recently, was involved in work with pro-Israel advocacy groups. And so in this episode, we'll not only talk about how his family back home is doing and his assessment of Gaza's future, but we'll also get his perspective on the response of Christian Zionists in the U.S. to the mass killings of Palestinians and the existential threat that Palestinian Christians face. Khalil Saeg, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Arif, for having me. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
So before we begin, I just wanted to note that you and your family have paid a great price in this conflict. Your father passed away in December. He was among the many Christians sheltering at the Holy Family Church in Gaza, and he passed away due to a heart attack and was unable to get medical care. And that's a direct result of the siege on the church and Gaza by the Israeli military. And so on behalf of all our listeners, I just wanted to express our prayers and our best wishes for you and your family, and that your father rests in peace.
Thank you, Arif. It's been a really, really hard time for me and for the rest of residents of Gaza and those who have relatives there. And I really appreciate your condolences.
Now, you have family that remains in Gaza, including in North Gaza, and conditions there are really dire. On Wednesday, the head of USAID, Samantha Power, said that famine is already occurring in northern Gaza. And prior to this, the UN and other international organizations warned that it was imminent. She said on Wednesday, one in three kids in northern Gaza are malnourished, and there are expectations that severe acute malnutrition for young kids will continue to rise. So I'm wondering, how is your family faring right now, and what have they been telling you about conditions there?
Yeah, so the situation has been really different. The entire infrastructure is destroyed. Schools, bakeries, markets have been destroyed, etc. But there has been a very precise and handmade famine in the north that Israel literally is stopping the food from getting into the Gaza Strip to use it as a pressure to achieve whatever goals to have are wanting to achieve. And the implication of that for people like my family who are living at the church in the north of Gaza is that they have been really struggling to get food. And for the last 6 months, during Lent, at the time where Christians in Gaza, like the rest of the Christians around the world, were fasting, didn't even have access to fruits or vegetables. Imagine that. For over 6 months, you don't have access to fruits and vegetables. And that's a time where you're supposed to not consume any animal products, etc. So it has been really, really hard to access food. When you access it, it's very expensive. And when you access it, it's the type of food that is not really that healthy. You get certain cant of corn, for example, or a cant of tuna or something, because that's the type of aid you can like send it or drop it, etc. But fruits, vegetables, meat were not really available. But interestingly enough, Arif, after the killing of the World Central Kitchen by the Israeli army, and after the Biden administration pressure and the call to Netanyahu to open the Erez-Brook border from the north. We've seen more of it getting into Gaza. For the first time since about 5 months, my family told me that they were able to access protein, animal protein. They were able to access chicken for the first time in 5 months. And that's groundbreaking in a way, but at the same time, it's the bare minimum. You would think that America would pressure Israel way before that to allow such a thing to get into Gaza. So the situation got better, but still not that better, because not only is the challenge that the borders are closed, but the challenge is the complete collapse of social order because of the Israeli bombardments. And this is, I think, the bigger issue is like, how do you recreate the social order when Israel is determined to target any institution that tries to maintain law and order?
Right. And we'll get to that in a bit. But, on this question of genocide and famine, and, you may have seen these articles that have come out from, pro-Israel advocates that have tried to dispute the notion that there are, mass civilian deaths or an impending famine. And then, if anyone ever tweets about genocide or famine, there are these people who just emerge out of nowhere and reply and show pictures of, let's say, a shawarma stand in South Gaza, when in fact we know, the conditions are pretty dire in the north. And so there is this ecosystem of disinformation and denialism regarding the famine, which is counters the consensus of the international community and even senior U.S. officials, like Samantha Power and many others, and as well as others in the non-governmental space in Washington. And so people who have been very reluctant to criticize Israel have now been pretty blunt in terms of either saying that famine is imminent or underway. So I'm wondering, as a Palestinian from Gaza and a Palestinian from Gaza with family who's there right now facing this potential famine or famine that is underway, how does this denialism, how does this disinformation that even comes from Americans, how does it make you feel?
It obviously makes me feel sick. But I have to always step back and think. And see things clearly. I mean, on the one hand, I do know that generally, whenever there is any genocide happening, whoever the nationalist group are that are committing it or supporting it, there has been always denials in Iran. There has been always an attempt to fabricate the facts and to cherry-pick certain incidents or anecdotals and try to promote them as, oh, that's the reality, such as what you mentioned, they bring a picture of shawarma in the south of Gaza, the area that is capable of receiving some of the aid, and say, oh, there is no famine of Gaza, while the problem is in the north, actually, more, etc. So yeah, so these things happen all the time. And on the other hand, I do have to acknowledge that the source of this misinformation and these claims, it's not only people who come up with these things. There is a particular apparatus within Israel, the propaganda apparatus, what they call the Hasbara machine, which is a Hasbara, the Hebrew word to explain. It's an entire department within the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Israel to try to spread these lies day and night. Let's be honest. The spokesperson of the Israeli government during the war, Ilan Levy, was one of the most disinformation accounts on Twitter, that he went after everyone, spreading the lies, claiming that there is no famine, claiming that food is getting into Gaza, etc. So it's not something surprising for me. I mean, the Israelis have been doing this for a while. They've been doing it about settler violence in the West Bank. They've been doing it about the way Jerusalem is being really changed in its character to become more and more exclusively Jewish. So there's nothing surprising in there. And the unfortunate reality that the Israeli government and the Zionist movement in general have managed to build what I would call a robust civil society organizations in the U.S. that also buy into this propaganda and spread it. It's a really dark and painful thing. I mean, I would actually tell you, and I will end with that, Arif, that it feels to me, and I told a Jewish friend of mine this week, that when people deny these things, atrocities or even the famine, to me, as a Palestinian, it feels the same way as to a Jewish person when someone denied the Holocaust. I'm not saying that there is equivalency morally there, between both. But I say on the feeling level, the denialism feels the same.
Right. And there's obviously the fog of war, so to speak, in any conflict, right? And there are claims and counterclaims. But on the question of famine itself, there's no real dispute. We have governmental and non-governmental entities across the board that have no real partisan role in this conflict, and some that are even aligned with Israel, like the U.S. government, that are saying in clear terms that famine is either underway or imminent in North Gaza, at least, and as well as potentially other parts of Gaza. And so what's really striking about this is that, you know, these are not just hotheads who are, let's say, live in some settlement in the West Bank and are tweeting nonsense. We have university professors here in the United States who are writing articles in publications, respected publications that have mass readership, and they're trying to sort of muddy the discourse and create at least some ambiguity, if not contest what is a real clear and present danger in Gaza. And it points toward what is really a dangerous game that the objective is to give maximum space to Israel to conduct its military operations and whatever objectives it has in Gaza, or whatever objectives it believes or claims it has in Gaza, and to remove all barriers to that. And that is even applies toward efforts to avert a famine in Gaza, which, you know, God forbid, could kill thousands or tens of thousands of people. And so it's a very dangerous game, and it points toward something that is very dark among those who engage in pro-Israel advocacy, that they're willing to go to those lengths and ultimately sacrifice that many lives of Palestinians. And it shows, I think, the willingness of them to sort of take things to that degree. And this is sort of Rwanda-style genocidal politics that takes place in a more respectable form. So it's not someone shouting epithets and things like that. It's much more calculated, and it's done by sort of white-collar individuals who have respectability because they have PhDs and so on and so forth. And that makes it even more insidious. And I wish people were able to talk about it in more clear terms, because the clock is ticking, and so every week matters. And even when it comes to the question of famine, that is a sort of a lagging indicator. And so once a famine is formally declared, it means it's already been underway for quite some time. And so in some parts of Gaza, we may be beyond the point of no return. And as you had noted, this is ultimately man-made, because all it took was one call from Biden to get some of the border crossings open and alleviate conditions to some degree. But I mean, we're talking about feeding hundreds of thousands or millions of people. Famine and starvation is not something you can just kind of undo with, you know, a single meal.
Yeah, yeah. And ultimately, Arif, the issue that we're dealing with, the fact that people are willing to deny even famine, I would not say that this built overnight. I don't say that this just built after October 7th. Like, it took 2 weeks and people just turned to be like moral monsters, all of a sudden denying famine in Gaza, all of a sudden denying that Palestinians are being starved to death in Gaza. I think it's been building over years of dehumanizing the Palestinians, years of claiming that even the occupation is not really occupation, it's perhaps disputed territory. So years of denying that perhaps every attack by the Palestinians is unprovoked, that they're just, you know, some sort of savages, that they want to kill us for the sake of killing us. They're jihadists, they're you name it. So if you really view the Palestinian in these terms, if you really refuse to see any legitimate grievances for the Palestinians who are living under occupation for that long, I think it's inevitable that when something tremendous and awful like this happens, it's that you tend to also believe the lies against the Palestinians, and you deny their pain. And that's the unfortunate reality that we're facing with today. We are seeing the results of years and years of complete dehumanizations of the Palestinians.
Right. And, you know, there's this meme of Pallywood that Palestinians supposedly faking the atrocities that are being inflicted on them. And, you know, this goes back to, the killing of Muhammad Ad-Dura. And I think it was 2001. 2000 or 2001. Yeah, 2001. And so there's a real pattern to this disinformation campaign by Israel in terms of these incidents that, you know, when the world focuses on it and tries to hold it accountable, there's a clear pattern of behavior that they engage in to, one, stop the criticism, create confusion, and then help people forget about it and avoid accountability. And this has been going on for decades. And we have very established institutions here that partake in these exercises. There are networks involved. And also, you know, people have been habituated. They've been cultured to believe that Israelis are truthful and Palestinians are liars. And ultimately, that's why it's taken, as you noted, so long for people to accept some fundamental elements of this war that in Gaza that Israel is waging. Now, when senior Israeli official, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant says, "We are imposing a complete siege on Gaza. There will be no electricity, no food, no water, no fuel." He said that on in October, and that was a policy statement. That was a declaration of intent, and Israel's actions after that assumed that form. And still, people were denying that Israel was doing all this, and various elements within the sort of Hasbara apparatus denied it. But in the end, its actions prove that that's exactly what its policy was. And you know, just continuing on that question of hunger and famine, you know, much of the discourse has been about these aid trucks coming in and through air as well. This is going to be a long-term problem, right? Because when we look at Gaza, much of the farmland is in the east. And that area essentially will become, Israel's goal is to make that part of its security buffer. And so at least in terms of locally grown fruits and vegetables and other products, they're not really going to be able to supply themselves, right? Because so much of that farmland has been either destroyed or appropriated by Israel. So this is not going to be a situation that can be easily reversed overnight, right?
No, not at all. No, I think the farmlands, et cetera, has been completely destroyed. And as you said, 16% of the Gaza Strip is already part of the new buffer zone that Israel is creating. This is the majority of farmland in Gaza. And I don't see this changing anytime soon. The other issue, too, is all the factories that used to produce any food in Gaza were destroyed. The bakeries are still not being rebuilt in the north of Gaza. There have been some talks that Israel will work with the UN to ensure that 20 bakeries will work after the Biden pressure, but we did not see this change. But ultimately, as you say, the main challenge is in that even after the war is over, like, it would take Gaza a really long time to fix these issues. But really, unless Gaza's siege is addressed once and for all, even if the situation incrementally, or nothing even incremental, let's say a little bit improves after the war is over, there will still be institutional conditions that were made during this war that will stay with us for 10 or 20 years from now. And that's why I personally think that the Israeli goal and the Israeli policy is that they created these conditions of unlivable or uninhabitable Gaza. So the people would, if they were not even forcibly ethnic cleansed right now, that there would be an incremental ethnic cleansing, that they would just leave by themselves, because why not to leave when all the conditions on the ground does not allow you to live dignified life in Gaza anymore.
Right. And, you know, we even saw in the initial months of this conflict, Palestinians didn't want to leave their homes. And now we're seeing many seek to leave the country. And so,
for sure.
And that is a change in mindset, because they literally have no homes to go back to. And this conflict, you know, many had said that the operations would end at some point in January because of pressure from the Biden administration. But it's April now. And so this could go on for quite some time. Now, in terms of the long-term damage, the World Bank recently released a report, and it said between 80 to 96% of Gaza's agricultural infrastructure has been damaged or destroyed, and the economy in the last quarter of 2023 shrunk by 80%. It termed it one of the largest economic shocks ever recorded in recent history. And so, obviously, there's going to be calls for tremendous amount of international aid coming in if and once these operations end. But I mean, as you noted, this is going to be a shock that will last longer than a decade. And so this is not a video game. This is real life, and entire systems have been destroyed. And so that is a consequence, a direct consequence of how Israel has chose to proceed with this war in Gaza, because it's not simply targeting Hamas. It's also literally devastating the infrastructure of Gaza, eliminating homes, factories, agricultural infrastructure, and families. And so when you kill bread earners, that means those who are dependent on them are left destitute or dependent on others. Now, I want to pivot to the question of order in Gaza. It may seem strange to talk about this given the potential for famine, but when we talk about feeding people, when we talk about securing people, that requires systems, organizations, and personnel to do that, right? It's not just collections of random individuals. And so it's part of a discussion that I think is inadequately dealt with. And it's important not just in terms of the status quo, but in terms of the future, if and once these operations end. Now, before October 7th, there was a government in place in Gaza. Hamas ruled the Gaza Strip. There were obvious limitations on its power. Gaza and Palestine is not a sovereign entity. Israel controlled the airspace and borders. Gaza, Hamas did not have an air force or missile defense system, and so it could literally be pummeled whenever Israel felt the desire to do so. So I'm wondering, where do things stand now, given Israel's targeting of Hamas, not just Hamas militants, but also the Gaza civil police force? Who is in control of Gaza right now, if anyone is? And what is left of the previous regime, so to speak?
This is a good question. I mean, the truth is, there is no simple answer for that because it's really complex. And there are different areas, obviously. In the north, one can say that the social order generally have collapsed. We've seen emergence of gangs and clans and other groups that are controlling part of Gaza. We've seen also a tremendous increase in crime, killing. We've seen organized crime where people would rob and steal houses that were left or being bombed. But at the same time, we've seen also the Hamas's police trying to operate in civilian clothes against those kind of actions in the north. However, even as they were trying to do that, we've seen that the Israelis were still targeted. And there is a very clear sense in the north that the Israelis are interested in continuing the state of lawlessness in the north. And I would say that the north is perhaps the most, you know, lawless area, as opposed to the south. When you go to Rafah, let's say, we'd still see Hamas's government relatively functioning more. There's still civil services, there's still civilian police. Even in the middle of Gaza, like let's say Mukhayam al-Sirat or Deir al-Balah, there's still a functioning government there. Khan Yunis, we've seen also a collapse. Now they're trying to rebuild it, whatever. But I would say, yeah, just generally, there is lack of social order. Hamas have shown, to be honest, for someone who has been bombarded for 6 months, they have shown great resilience in the sense that they keep re-emerging, not only as a military guerrilla fighters, this is still going on, but they try to keep re-emerge as a government. And on the other hand, they're also cracking down on any populist movement that try to establish, let's say, what we would call it, Lijan Shabiya, like populist committees that to protect their neighborhood or their area, because Hamas want to ensure that no alternative body of governing the strip will re-emerge out of this chaos. So there is also that struggle internally where Hamas want to ensure that no other emerge so that they will re-emerge after war and control Gaza.
Right. And speaking of those alternative structures, there have been reports that Israel is trying to develop a kind of a depoliticized power structure there, putting at the center the clans or families, powerful families in Gaza. And this is a tactic that Israel has used over the decades.
Yes.
You know, back in the 1970s when it wanted to isolate Fatah and the Palestinian Liberation Organization, or PLO, it engaged them. So I'd like you to help our listeners understand who are these clans in Gaza? Why are they important? And what is the history of Israel's attempts to leverage them against popular resistance organizations?
Yeah, so the clans are in Gaza are built on sort of extended families. Let's say, for example, certain historical family that lives in the Gaza Strip, such as, the Dolmash family, for example. It's them and their cousin and their extended Gaza, and they sort of organize clans over time. And part of their clan is that they have guns and they have some sort of organized group, militia groups, etc. Majority of these major clans, as I said, they're originally from Gaza, meaning that before 48, before the Nakba, they were there. And there are some who are refugees. But the biggest clans, let's say, Hillis, Dolmash, and others, are indeed from the Gaza Strip itself. For as other traditional societies, clans and tribes and families have exerted certain power, generally, historically. For example, they would solve social issues. If you had a fight with your cousin, instead of going to the police, you would go to the head of the tribe and they can fix these issues, etc. However, during the period when the Palestinian Authority have controlled the Gaza Strip, just especially after the Second War, we've seen that clans have become tremendously involved in crime. They were fighting rivalry wars over who gets to govern certain areas, who get to make decisions over certain issues, but also, you know, wars of revenge, like fighting of revenge and stealings, etc. And this caused a lack of legitimacy for the Palestinian Authority. It challenged its legitimacy, and it challenged the social order generally in Gaza, because Gaza, the majority of people are refugees. They don't belong to any of these clans, and they don't feel attachment to them. To see them trying to run things and to impose certain order was not accepted by the Palestinian people. But the Palestinian Authority never cracked down on them, and they never tried to do it, because the Palestinian Authority saw itself as more weak, and they saw that they need certain support by the clans to gain legitimacy in Gaza. When Hamas took over in 2007, things have shifted and changed. Not only Hamas did not need the legitimacy of the clans, but they didn't need any sort of protection from them. And they went on and limited their power entirely. They had to even go at certain point to certain areas and kill some of the men that are armed from these clans, such as the Hillis clan and the Hamas. And we've seen change in the order in Gaza, where Hamas really had a centralized power. The government could enter any of these areas, something the Palestinians are doing. Now, Israel has been talking about restoring these clans, and we don't know how successful they are at talking to them, because we've seen a lot of these clans coming out and saying, no, we will not work with anyone but the Palestinian Authority or even any other Palestinian factions. We wouldn't work with the occupation. There have been some reports that there is one or two of the clans that have discussed things with Israel. However, that's a very dangerous phenomena, because A, the clans cannot be as trusted as our history tells us on one hand. The second, that it will further fragment the Palestinian society, because you will have a foreign government intervening, trying to empower one clan that the majority of the Palestinian people don't see as legitimate. And that's a serious challenge. But overall, one can say with certain level of certainty right now that Israel understand right now that the clan plan has failed already, and that the Palestinians will not accept it, and that even the clans themselves will not accept such.
You know, when it comes to Israel's strategy, what we've seen since October 7th is that either the Israeli government or Israeli politicians or Israel-aligned voices in that region or in the U.S. and elsewhere have floated these various ideas about establishing some kind of order in Gaza. And they've been these random ideas. You know, in the initial weeks and months of the war, Brett Stevens and others in the New York Times talk about an international peacekeeping force made up of from Arab countries, including Egypt and Saudi Arabia. There are all these random ideas that come out, and there is actually no strategy, because, you know, Netanyahu has his own political goals, and there is this larger goal of eliminating Hamas, and it's not really quite attainable, but Israel essentially is on autopilot, and it doesn't have actual resistance in terms of proceeding on the ground, because the Biden administration is essentially, when it comes to the bottom line, is that it's essentially letting it proceed as it wishes, serving as a defensive mechanism against international pressure. I'm wondering, in your view, would you agree with that assessment, or do you think Israel has an actual strategy, or is it kind of making up as it goes along? Is, you know, you talked about the differences in terms of order in the North and South. So does that point towards the absence of a real overarching strategy, or is this chaos really part of Israel's broader goals?
That's a good question. I find myself really pondering about this really all the time. And my analysis is that there are two options. A, Israel really had a strategy and they have failed with it. And that's a result of this really failure of the strategy that they've had. Or the second one, that they really didn't have strategy and they were just going around doing whatever they want. And they had this very elusive goal, such as dismantling or eliminating Hamas, that's dismantling their government, etc., which they never really define what the political outcome or goal out of that. And thus they are stuck at this limbo. But what I say when I say, what I mean when I say that they had a strategy and they failed with it, I do think that it was the ethnic cleansing, that they would go to Egypt. I am of the school, of the people who thought that when Benjamin Netanyahu, pushed on certain Western actors to talk to the Egyptians of opening the borders, when he was trying to push Egypt to open, when there was the Minister of Intelligence published this memo, working memo, where it suggests that we have to pay Egypt to open the border, etc. I'm at the school of the thought that they were serious about it. There really was tremendous pressure in Egypt to open the borders, and have Egypt open the border, I think that Israel could have just continued to use the same weapons that they're using right now, starvation, bombing, etc., to at least ethnic cleanse 50% of the country. And I think have that succeeded, would have been a totally different game. What Israel would be thinking of, rebuilding settlements in Gaza, they'd be really working hard. Although still, the right-wing sort of fascist faction within the Israeli government still talking about settlements. But they understand that it's not realistic. And they understand that they cannot live among 2 million hostile people there. But I think really they wanted the ethnic cleansing and they failed. And as they failed right now, they're stuck. Because on the one hand, they're there and they want to get rid of Hamas. On the other hand, they don't want a political out. They don't want to work with the Palestinian Authority. They don't want to work with other actors. They don't want Hamas to be reinstated. So they are stuck in that place. Their only hope was to completely eradicate the Palestinian people or ethnic cleanse them, and they failed to an extent. But what is scary about it is that, as I said before, yes, they've failed in the short term to really bring about massive ethnic cleansing, but the conditions they've created, I think, will pave the way toward an incremental ethnic cleansing of Palestinian people in Gaza.
Right. And it goes back to sort of the early days of the Zionist movement, where the physical presence of Palestinians in Palestine was a barrier to the achievement of their objectives, right? When they were just 5, 10% of the population and they had aspirations to create a homeland there, there were other people there. And so they're really a problem, because how do you convince someone to go somewhere else? How do you convince people to leave the land of their ancestors? Ultimately, when you look at the memoirs of or the diaries of David Ben-Gurion and others, they acknowledge that force was going to be part of that strategy to achieve a contiguous entity for Jews who turn to what they regard as their homeland, because in the end, there were other people there and they had to move them. And that's called ethnic cleansing. And now we see that taking place in Gaza. And so in the early months after October 7th, we had people like Danny Dannon, who's part of the cabinet, but not really aligned with Netanyahu, who's sort of a rival within the Likud. And he was arguing for Western countries to take in Gaza refugees. Now, this is a person who's an unabashed bigot. He disdains Palestinians. So he's not arguing for Western countries to take them because he loves them, because he loves Palestinians, but because he wants them out of this area. And for the Israeli military, it would certainly be easier to conduct a campaign to wipe out Hamas if there are no civilians there. But they're literally fighting in this congested space in which millions of people inhabit. These are their places of residence, of work. And so, they're choosing to operate on these terms in this place. And so, the cleansing, the ethnic cleansing serves the military interests, but also these more extreme political interests of the ultra far-right Zionists within the Netanyahu coalition. Now, speaking of ethnic cleansing, among the Palestinians is a substantial Christian population, and it's a population that's shrunk in size over the decades. And this is, you know, where Christianity originated. And as you write in the New Arab recently, this is the first time in 2,000 years that the Christian presence in Gaza may be wiped out. What strikes me about this is that when we saw that, for example, when ISIS was spreading and in the 2010s, and it was targeting religious minorities in the Middle East, whether it was the Yazidis or the Christians, and you know, we saw many people, for example, add the letter Noon in Arabic to their Twitter profile out of solidarity with the Christians who were, you know, facing a campaign of extermination by ISIS. So we saw examples of Christians in the U.S. and elsewhere engage in a kind of a pan-Christian solidarity because of a clear and present danger that Christian communities in the Middle East faced. Now, many of these individuals are silent. Not all of them. You know, it's not, there are many different Christian denominations here in the U.S., but I guess the loudest among them here, in terms of the evangelicals, are really silent about what's happening to Palestinian Christians. I mean, there's literally, you talked about your family in the north, and then in the south, there's also a Catholic church. I think in the north, it's a Greek Orthodox church. And, you know, there's a Palestinian Christian sheltering there. God forbid, all it takes is one attack, and most of them could be, you know, removed from this world. And so I'm wondering, as a Christian, don't you find the silence here, at least among those who are most publicly Christian, to be quite bizarre?
It's not only bizarre, it's rather painful. I mean, you look at these people and you see them as your siblings in Christ, and you see that they're silent about it. But even worse, not only silent, but some of them would speak publicly in support of the genocide and call even on Israel to use even nuclear power and nuclear weapon and to wipe the Palestinians from. But that's not a new phenomenon. This is an old phenomenon in the U.S. It goes back all the way to the 48, where the Palestinians were not supposed to be there. In the biblical narrative that many of these people have believed in, is that the Jewish people have to return to their land, what they perceive as their land, as a fulfillment of prophecy of some sort. And the Arabs there, they were not supposed to be there. There's no Arabs, whatever. But when it comes to the Christians, most of them, majority of Christians here in the U.S. who adhere to certain theology as such, they're just not aware of the Palestinian Christian presence. They're not aware that when Israel was established in 1948, they ethnically cleansed Christians just as Muslims. But not only that, they destroyed churches. Over 30 churches were destroyed in 48. Even in 67, when Israel occupied the Golan Heights, where Syrian Christians used to live alongside Muslims, they ethnically cleansed everyone, Christians and Muslims, and only preserved the Druze community there, minority, because of certain political calculation within. So no, it's really painful, and it's really rather defeating to see your Christian brothers and sisters not talk about any sort of persecution or ban that happens to the Palestinian Christians or the Christians in general in the Middle East, except when it's done on the hands of the Muslims. So that's on one level. It's a lot of problems with their theology, with their perception of what's happening in the Middle East. But to be a little bit more charitable, the majority of Christians who are not part of the elites, or they're not part of like institutions that are Zionist, like let's say Christian United for Israel or others, they just really don't know. They never heard. They've been always filled with this idea that Israel is the weaker side and they are standing against this sort of savage other Islamist groups, etc. They're not aware of our existence as Palestinian Christians. They're not aware of what really the reality there. But what I would say to that for the first time in history, actually, Arif, we are seeing a breakthrough, even among right-wing Christians, conservative in America. For the first time, some of them are listening and that they're thinking, why are we supporting Israel when they're really literally bombing churches? And we've seen in St. Porphyrios, when the bombing happened in October 17th, that was one of the biggest massacres against Christians in the Middle East. That was really big. We are talking that 18 Palestinian Christians were killed, majority of whom are children, while at church by an Israeli Air Force. So I think there is more and more people who are seeing that. But the gatekeepers, what I call the gatekeepers, who are the elites who are connected to Zionist institutions and Zionist theology, they're trying and working hard to make sure that young generations of Christians who see the reality either change their opinions or that they are silent.
Right. And you know, it's important to note that mainline Protestant denominations have actually been pretty outspoken on the Palestinian question for quite some time. So that includes the Presbyterian Church here in the U.S., the Quakers, the United Methodist Church has opposed Israeli settlements. The Evangelical Lutheran Church of America has called for an end to the occupation. So, you know, when we talk about Christians here in the U.S., I think in general, I think those who are most outspoken are white evangelicals who really adhere to a kind of a specific end times doctrine. And then there are other Christians who, one, have great feelings of solidarity with Palestinian Christians, but also look at things from the social justice perspective, which they find inherent to the Christian tradition. And that has really, especially with the Quakers, that has really, I think, anchored their view towards the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And so I think it's important to note the diversity among elements within the Christian community here in the U.S. And then even more globally, you know, the Catholic Church has been pretty outspoken on human rights in Palestine and Israel, as well as many other parts of the world, irrespective of the religious context. And so, you know, here in the U.S., we often use Christian as a shorthand for a specific demographic in terms of white evangelical Christians, but there are also Black Christians who are mainly Protestant, Latinos, and others who are Catholic. And so none of these groups have a monopoly over the right to speak as a Christian. And there are so many that approach this as an issue of social justice and not through the prism of end times doctrine. Now, in your own personal experience, you were involved with some of these groups. And, you know, what I've noticed is many of them have, one, they're more or less silent about what's happening to Palestinian Christians today. But when we look at, one, the funding patterns and the behavior, one, you know, a lot of the funding is coming from individuals who are expressly pro-Israel and may not even be Christian. And it seems to me that the aim here is to create a wedge between Palestinian Christians and Muslims. And so when we look at the Palestinian National Movement and even Arab nationalism at a broader level, I mean, there have been so many prominent Palestinian Christians, and their religious identity may not have been at the forefront of their activism. But and you know, that's how humans operate everywhere, right? You know, it's not people have multiple identities, and some are relevant in some contexts and some are not. And so we have Edward Said, Hanan Ashrawi. When we look at the idea of Arab nationalism, sort of a pan-Arab nationalism, Michel Aflaq, one of the sort of inventors of the Arab nationalist idea, at least in a sort of a very modern form. But when we look at these groups that are active in the U.S., that are trying to create this wedge between Palestinian Christians and Muslims, one of their key, I think, strategies is to sort of de-Arabicize Palestinian and Arab Christians and say, oh, no, you know, we were Arabicized by Muslim invaders, and then sort of taking away all that commonality. But when we look at history, especially in the modern era, Arab nationalism has been very multi-religious. Talk to us about that strategy of these groups in terms of how they're trying to create these wedges within Palestinians and how you came to sort of learn about that through your own experience.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just to start with, before I get into the details of that, I want to acknowledge that, yes, Arab nationalism has been multi-ethnic and multicultural in many ways and even multi-religion. But it did still produce challenges for people who do indeed have this other layer of identity, such as Syrian Christians, or even like non-Christians, such as Kurds and Iraq and in Syria. There was, as in the case of any other nationalism, right? Like the
Absolutely,
other ethnicity
yeah.
would have struggled to speak their languages. And there was certain thing to like restore part of these identities. But I think what these groups are trying to produce more, not only to try to make your sort of some groups such as like, let's say, Christian Copts or Assyrian Christians, their ethnic identity more salient, but to try to redefine it in a way that has to do with anti-Islam, or the idea that, that Muslims are the invaders and that we have to liberate ourselves from this invasion, etc. But I would even go farther to say that the matter of fact, these things has nothing to do with Christianity or like caring about, let's say, Assyrian Christians or even Coptic Christians in Egypt. It has to do more with trying to create a similar narrative that will be in alignment with Zionism in the region and how the this Orientalist thinking about how the region look like, and then try to sell it to the Americans here so it's more winnable. So you can go to Catholics and sell them the story about the Christians' alliance with the Zionism and how they perceive it the same thing as opposed to the majority Muslims. And I think that's has been the ultimate goal there, that that's what they were trying to do. Now, on the Palestinian front, they didn't succeed whatsoever, because the Palestinians are quite firm in their identity and how they see their Muslim brothers and sisters as one big part of their national identity. There is a whole feeling of really breathance, that we're breathance, that Muslims and Christians, that they were part of the same people. However, Palestinian Christians did feel a certain level of discomfort with the emergence of the Islamist movement since the 2000s. The fact that Hamas has emerged meant that there were also the questions that Palestinian Christians start asking about what does it mean to be Palestinians in light of Hamas's leadership for a big part of the Palestinian movement. And I do think that some of these groups in the U.S. tried to capitalize on that and use it. And I'll tell you, as Khalil myself, I've been always critical of Hamas. And because of that, I was approached one time by one of these groups who are based in New York. I was hired and was working for them. And the whole work was to try to understand Palestinian Christians more, explain their story to the world, etc. But I was surprised, rather, that they're only interested about me when I'm critical of Hamas. They only want me to talk about Hamas, about quote-unquote Muslim persecution, etc. But when we did a research with the Palestinian Center for Surveys and Studies, we found out that the one number one problem of the Palestinian people in West Bank and Gaza is the economical difficulties. Number two problem was what? Was the occupation. And number three was the Israeli settlers' terrorism. They literally jumped over these three facts and went to like number four factors and number fifth factor, which is the discomfort from Islamist movement, which was like 70% were feeling discomfort, as opposed to like 90-something percent who feel like the biggest threat is the occupation. So I start feeling that these groups were not really interested about us and about the Christian story. They were rather more interested in the Christian story as long as it serves a particular Orientalist perception of the Middle East that ultimately served the state of Israel. That it's not only Orientalist, but it as long as it serves the state of Israel.
Right. And, you know, it even extends beyond, the Palestinian question. So, for example, some of these groups, they, you know, are very focused on what's happening in the conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia in Nagorno-Karabakh. And they're framing it in religious terms. But when you look at Azerbaijan, it's actually a very secular country. It's actually an ally of Israel. It's currently supplying it with fuel. And they are trying to sort of paint things in this binary where it's Muslims versus Christians and Jews. And it doesn't align with the complex realities here. And then, you know, we have Armenians in Jerusalem who are being attacked by Jewish extremists. And these groups are silent about that. So, you know, it's important to speak out about Armenians when they're being persecuted in the Caucasus. But what about in Israel-Palestine? What about in Jerusalem? They're silent. And so, as you had noted, the aim here is to leverage this group, Palestinian Christians, to serve, you know, Israel's purposes. But it's not about the inherent value that those people have, irrespective of where they are and who the challenge to them is coming from. Now, you know, you talked about the discomfort and the concern that many Palestinian Christians have as a result of the rise of Hamas as a governing force, as a political force, since the 2000s. And that can be corrected if Fatah and the PLO and the PA get their act together, right? And so we have a very malleable political structure in Palestine where, you know, right now there's a majority doesn't support a single group in Palestine, right? And so in public opinion polls. And if, for example, a more legitimate force enters the fray, someone like, let's say, Marwan Barghouti, who comes from, you know, from Fatah and has more legitimacy in the eyes of many Palestinians and, you know, is essentially a secular politician, then that can kind of address, you know, many of the concerns that many Palestinian Christians have because of the fears of being their rights and their place in society being diminished by a force that may be acting in majoritarian terms and not being inclusive enough and even imposing its values and maybe even in some instances persecuting Christians, right? And so there's enough room within the Palestinian political spectrum for a rebalancing to take place. And it doesn't have to be fit into a thousand-year historical narrative where Muslims have been the perennial enemies of Christians.
Absolutely. I would tell you, no matter who we don't choose, I mean, no matter who we choose as Palestinian Christians, it will not be Israel. We don't see Israel as a savior. We don't see Israel as a positive force in the Middle East. The truth is that Israel, if anything, it increases the sectarian divisions in the Palestinian territories. It even created sectarian divisions within a set of Israel, within the minorities who live there. And to us, Palestinian Christians, we see that the only way to survive in the Middle East is to move beyond the sectarianism into a national identity that represents the collective of the Palestinian people. And that's the Palestinian national secular identity that we believe in. But Israel is literally trying to impose a different reality in which sectarian groups sort of have their own ethno-religious identity and through which they can be also subordinated to the occupation, something that we completely refuse. And it's really horrific to see some of these groups who are, I can say with certainty that they're not funded by even Christian, funded by particular Zionist institutions, pushing that narrative all in service of what the Israeli project tried to do in the region.
Right. And these groups are funded by, you know, there's one individual who funds a number of groups and they're all kind of, there's an echo chamber where one group says one thing and then it's promoted by the other. And it creates this a louder voice that is not representative of the reality on the ground, but it's a testament to what, you know, just millions of dollars can do in terms
exactly.
of promoting. It's simple fact of money. And so you have these random individuals emerge and they may tweet some things that they like, and then all of a sudden they become a fellow somewhere and they become representatives of, let's say, Palestinian Christians or someone from Gaza.
Exactly.
And then they start writing in Newsweek and these other publications. And then when you talk to Palestinians, they're like, he does not represent us. So, you know, they tend to privilege these individuals who put the lives of ordinary Palestinians secondarily. And so someone will say, Israel just killed 30, 40 of my relatives yesterday. But it's all Hamas's fault.
Yeah, I see that.
And it's weird. It's like a cult-like behavior. It doesn't make sense, like as a human being, how a normal human being will respond. And it's a testament to, you know, the power of money. And this applies to any group, right? So, you know, someone, you can get someone to say smoking is good for you and you pay him $1 million a year and he'll do it. It's not like a conspiracy or it has nothing to do with any inherent behavior of any group. It's just interests and power and money and how the U.S. works. Because ultimately this is about models of sort of propagating ideas within the U.S. political system. And this is how the system is gamed by various forms of lobbies.
For sure.
And it's not just, you know, sort of, you know, pro-Israel forces
for sure.
On their own. Now, when we talk about representation and a future political dispensation in Palestine and right now in sort of, you know, the areas of the West Bank and Gaza, we have a range of proposals that are being floated. For example, the former Palestinian Prime Minister, Salam Fayyad and others have called for a revitalized PLO that includes elements of Hamas. Others have called for the Palestinian Authority, which is this entity that was created by, you know, the Oslo Accords and is supposed to be this sort of temporary governing body in the Palestinian occupied territories. Others have called for that to be reformed. Now, Israel, as we've seen, has proposed a more depoliticized future. It claims it wants a total defeat of Hamas, and then it's called for bringing in a multinational force or powering the clans. And there are all these different ideas, but it's very much opposed to a pathway towards a representative, democratically elected Palestinian governing entity that can eventually become a sovereign national entity, an independent state. So when we look at these different proposals that are being floated, what do you see as most viable? You know, there's the talk of the PLO, the PA, and then Israel has its kind of, you know, frankly, deluded notions. What do you think is most viable?
The truth is that we'll be stuck for a while with Israel trying to achieve nothing in Gaza, trying to ensure lawlessness continues, trying to ensure that nothing good can emerge out of that. Because they're very clear, they don't want a Palestinian state. And they're very clear, they don't even recognize the existence of the Palestinian people. That's the type of government we have in Israel. But long term, they will realize that it failed. And if we're thinking that we're dealing with a rational actor in Israel, which is unfortunately we're not right now, but let's say a rational actor will be in Israel, he or she will realize that this is unsustainable. We can't continue that way. And we have to deal with the Palestinians to create some sort of government that will achieve two-state solution. I personally still think two-state solution is the only immediate or easiest path toward solving the Palestinian-Israeli issue. But for this to happen, you need the Israelis to engage. I mean, the Palestinian Authority has been, for the last at least 17 years or more, saying we're willing to negotiate tomorrow, we're willing to do it tomorrow, etc. The only way for this to happen is you need to reform, obviously, and fix the Palestinian Authority, but I don't think it's the type of reform that the U.S. wants. To be honest, what the U.S. wants is another subcontractor for the occupation, another Palestinian authority that, yeah, deals with some sort of issues on corruption, etc., but what they're more concerned about are the conditions that Israel have put. For example, they've been pushing for this entire thing that called pay to slay, what the Israelis have called pay to slay, which is a particular salary or social help for sons or daughters or even parents of someone who went to Israel, some of whom have committed actual, you know, like violent attacks on the Israelis, and others were there because of protest or they've thrown one stone. No. For the Palestinian Authority, this is one of the factors that gives its legitimacy. Beside that, that it's social service, that I would say even our duty as Palestinian people to help those of us who were imprisoned unjustly, the Americans want this to stop because Israel is telling them they want it to stop. Now, the BA is already lacking legitimacy because of their cooperation with Israel, because they arrest people who try to commit attacks, etc. So you add stuff like that, and what you're doing is you are disproving again and again that it's a national authority, and proving again and again it's that it's Western Israeli-backed government. And that would not work. It rather has to be an authentic Palestinian liberation organization. I think we need an authentic leader who represents our aspiration and who, while would be willing to work with Israel, does not take order from them. And we need to find that leader. And I think in the Palestinian street, there is general support and consensus to the idea that Marwan Barghouti can be that person. Marwan Barghouti is a Palestinian prisoner right now in Israeli jail, who's looked upon by the Palestinians and also by the Israeli left, by the way, someone on the Israeli left, as the Nelson Mandela of Palestine, that if he's freed from the Israeli jail, he can unite the Palestinians and he can lead toward a two-state solution.
Right. And it just seems that the present Israeli government, at least, and many of its predecessors, are really wedded to this idea of having a subcontractor in power. And so Marwan Barghouti is someone who has a kind of legitimacy and a sense of authority would be at odds with that, those desires. And there are actually reports that he may have been assaulted recently in prison. Yeah. And we see this consistently sort of in Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. So it has always tried to isolate popular forces among the Palestinians and then work through either depoliticized or forces that are lacking in legitimacy. And even with the Palestinian Authority, we saw the emergence of this office of the prime minister in the early 2000s to weaken Yasser Arafat. Yeah. And then there's always this little game that goes on. And, you know, when we look at Palestinian political culture, especially when compared to, you know, many other Arab societies, there's a pretty long tradition of political parties and even, you know, democratic politics.
Yeah, so exactly.
In 1954, in the West Bank, there were elections held under Jordanian rule. In the 1970s, there were actually a couple of elections held in the West Bank under the Israeli occupation. And we saw a turnout in the 60 to 70% range. In the 1976 elections, Israel tried to ensure that Fatah did not win, and it ended up doing so. They wanted to use the elections as a means to create an alternative political leadership, but that ended up blowing up in its face. In the 1980s, it very much tried to do the same. And then we see that today as well, when their engagement or lack thereof with various, and this plane, this Hamas versus Fatah and the PLO and the PA, Netanyahu strategy. And so it seems like it's a kryptonite for Netanyahu to have a legitimate, empowered Palestinian political force on the opposite end of the table. They want someone they can control, and they want someone who's dependent on them.
Yeah, for sure. That's the game for them. On the one hand, it's either you have a completely subcontractor of the occupation, or on the other hand, a force like Hamas that you can always point to and say, look, they're not partner for peace, they're terrorists, they're evil, whatever. But whatever it is, it's all in the service of continuation of the apartheid regime that exists today and the status quo to continue building settlements, etc., and to not to lead to a two-state solution.
When we look at the road ahead, it seems, as you said earlier, the most probable scenario is that some version of the status quo will continue, where, you know, the West Bank remains hot, Gaza is essentially in a state of manufactured chaos. The levels of chaos and famine and disorder are unequally distributed across Gaza. But in the end, there is an absence of a general absence of a functioning government and economy. And that may, you know, be the status quo that lasts not just for months, but maybe even years. But I'm wondering, in your view, and this is the final question, what steps can the Palestinians as a whole take to ensure that they are back on that track toward self-determination and sovereignty and having a state of their own? What steps can the different factions within the Palestinian political space and the people of Palestine take to put themselves on that path?
I do think that the Palestinians should do all the steps that is needed, and I will elaborate to what those are. But I would say that the unfortunate reality is that there is a world in which the Palestinians take all the steps needed and still you get nothing. And we've tried this over and over and over again in the last 20 years. It's not like we were always in this really, really difficult place of division and of lack of legitimacy for the Palestinian Authority, et cetera, to carry out the negotiations. It's rather the other way around. They always had more power and legitimacy or whatever. And always the Israelis did not want to talk about peace, and they built settlements, etc., that they weakened the Palestinians. But if it is that we have to just do our step and then see what comes next, I do think that the Palestinian Authority have to, the Palestinian Liberation Organization has to activate more its rules and its principles. The unfortunate reality is that the PLO has been not really abound, but its own constitution for the last few years. Abbas has been really this authoritarian figure who's really in charge of PLO without allowing any really political participation. And I think big part of that is that we have to accept some version of Hamas to become part of the PLO. And I don't mean that we will allow for Hamas's military wing to be part of the PLO, etc. But I mean certain political representations of the Islamists and Palestine have to become part of the PLO. There's no way around it. So that's one option. The other option, as I said, if Marwan Barghouti is out of prison, I do think that he will be able to give a lot of legitimacy to the Palestinian Authority and PLO, but even maybe Hamas will will make way more compromises to be part of this model. But again, you could do these things. I could argue that maybe in 2 or 3 weeks can happen. I can imagine a scenario which in 2 or 3 weeks this would happen, and still the Israelis would reject them. They will make a new excuse. They will make a new sort of claim similar to Betuslay, or similar to Orwell, they hate us. They teach their children we have to go to the textbook and just just ridiculous stuff that no one with his reasonable mind would believe, and still the West would believe them, and that's the issue. That's a problem. So I would say we should not be as much as focused as on the people under occupation and try to make them the perfect partner so we end the occupation, because ultimately the occupation is stripping people from their fundamental human rights. And we have to be focused at the oppressor, which is the state of Israel, telling them you have to end your occupation. The partner on the other side, if it's not there, they would emerge with the time. But you have to just prove to them, you have to show us that you're willing to even take up few settlements, to open the siege, to not humiliate people at checkpoints, whatever. And I tell you, the Palestinian political culture would change rapidly and quickly. And it's been done before and it can be done right now.
And that was Khalil Saikh of the Agora Initiative. Please subscribe to our show on your platform of choice. And thank you for tuning in.